the delight of creating a character who reinvents herself after 60.
I realize this is a murder mystery, and it's very much a proper murder mystery, but it's so much about the possibilities of a woman's life as she enters that third act.
That's master mystery writer Laura Lippman. We talk with her about her new novel, Murder Takes a Vacation. It brings back her character Muriel Blossom, now a wealthy single woman in her 60s, on a river cruise where art theft, murder, and self-reinvention intersect. Then, as New Yorkers begin voting in the Democratic primary for mayor, we revisit my 2021 conversation with Ross Barkin about his book, The Prince, Andrew Cuomo, the Coronavirus, and the Fall of New York. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, compelling conversations with authors who challenge, inspire, and inform. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, your favorite podcast app, or at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We begin this week's episode with crime fiction legend Laura Lippman. She tells us about her latest novel, Murder Takes a Vacation, a twisty, character-rich whodunit that also explores the power of friendship, pleasure, and starting over in the third act of life. The protagonist is Muriel Mrs. Blossom, a retired PI assistant turned millionaire lottery winner who embarks on a cruise down the Seine and finds herself caught up in art theft, murder, and rediscovering who she really is. Lippman shares why she wanted to write about an older female protagonist unapologetically enjoying her life, how friendship, fat phobia, ageism, and female pleasure inform the book, and why cozy mysteries are harder to write than noir. Along the way, we explore art world ethics, the joy of self-designing one's space, and why likable characters are the hardest to write. Let's listen now. Laura Lippman, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
Murder Takes a Vacation. This is a little bit different than many of your other novels. Many of them have featured private investigator Tess Monahan. This one has somebody who worked for Tess for a while, Muriel Blossom, Mrs. Blossom, as she's called in the book, who has retired. She's won almost $9 million in a through the lottery. What made you decide to bring her back and make her into a protagonist?
There are a couple of things at work. Primarily, selfishly, after writing two books back to back with incredibly unpleasant people in them, I wanted to spend some time with someone I considered nice. But I think also that I had become aware of ways in which I had shortchanged Mrs. Blossom when she was a secondary character. One reader had accused me of being ageist because she's not very comfortable with technology. And I remember at the time I said, well, that's just based on my mom. My mom's comfortable with technology. She just doesn't like it. She's a retired librarian. She just prefers not to be on computers, not to use cell phones. But, you know, that sort of piqued my interest to think about ageism and ways I might be contributing to it. And I also, sort of starting in 2018, so, you know, 5 years before I began working on this book, I had become increasingly interested in writers who were writing about the issue in our culture of fat phobia, which is a term that I paused while I'm trying to reach for it because some people don't like that term. They feel like you can't be phobic about fatness. But at any rate, I've been reading a lot of work by Aubrey Gordon, Virginia Soul Smith, which is about cultural expectations about women's bodies. And one of their underlying tenets is that fat is just a word. It's a factual description. And it's been used in our culture so much as a criticism, a reprimand, a recrimination. But perhaps we just need to accept the idea that bodies are bodies, and there's no right body to have, and there's no wrong body to have. And I realized that I had created this character, Muriel Blossom, who is fat. People are really uncomfortable with that word. I've noticed it even in like very approving reviews. There's some people who kind of pull their punches and don't want to use that word. That's what Mrs. Blossom is. And she's fine with it. She's not a woman who wants to change her body. Her body has brought her great joy. She's happy. She's strong. But she's aware that the world at large sees her and just sees her shape. So I felt like by bringing this character back, I could address any unintentional ageism, perhaps any unintentional critique that might have been suggested in the earlier writing. You know, the fact is, Mrs. Blossom and I were 20 years apart when I first started writing about her, and now we're just 2 years apart.
Yeah, you know, the press materials hint that you see something of yourself in her. You're very thin, so it's not that. What do you see? What is the personal connection?
Like Mrs. Blossom, I am a woman in my 60s who is not living the life I thought I was going to be living. I have divorced for a second time. I'm unusual in that I have a teenage daughter who's just finishing her freshman year of high school. And at 66, I'm alone, not in a relationship of any kind, except my friendships. And I really, really like it. And where maybe initially I was nervous and somewhat overwhelmed by being outside of the institution of marriage for really like the first time in over 30 years, because my two marriages, there was very, you know, I like married one guy, got a divorce, you know, started dating another guy. We were very quickly living together. So I've been married, if not to the same man, for most of my adult life. Mrs. Blossom and I have sort of the same span. She was married to one man for 30 years. I was married to two different men for 30 years. And while initially it was a little bit overwhelming and formidable, I'm at the happiest point in my life, and I'm seeing possibilities in life that I don't think I noticed before. So that's what Mrs. Blossom and I have in common.
Oh, that's really lovely. And as someone who is also older and has been single for a very long time, I can tell you it's just the best. I have absolutely no interest. I mean, I guess if it happened, you know, that's one thing.
I have to ask you this question. I know it's your podcast. You know, we're here to talk about writing. I am very sure. Sure, anything could happen. I do not wish to marry or cohabitate ever again. My mother ended up being such a great role model in that way. My father died. My mother was in her early 80s when my dad died. And she went on to live two more years. She died last year at the age of 93. She was having so much fun. I never saw my mother express any wistfulness for a partner or companionship. She had tons of friends. She was super active. And, you know, one of the interesting things about leaving a marriage after a long time within one is you get to do a lot of self-discovery. It's like, and that's what Mrs. Blossom is doing. It's like, she's beginning to ask herself for the first time in a long time, well, what do I want? What interests me? Where do I want to go? Where do I want to live? What kind of pictures do I want to hang on my walls? What kind of furniture do I want to buy? I mean, the whole world is spread out before her. Although I do think it is important to note, as has already been mentioned, she does have the advantage of wealth. And I would be disingenuous not to recognize that money is a big part of Mrs. Blossom's privilege. She has the means to experiment with life.
Exactly. And she's also not above, you know, a little romantic fantasizing.
Oh, gosh, no. I mean, she's definitely interested in sex. She has a healthy libido. Wait, that's unfair. That's a pejorative. You know, libidos are libidos, and whatever libido you have is probably healthy unless it's being changed by some sort of medical condition or pharmaceutical. she's interested in sex. She sees its possibilities, but she's not looking for another husband. That's never appealed to her. She had one great husband for 30 years, and she has the good sense to recognize that and not feel the need to replace him or try to replace him.
You know, her exploration of her own desires even goes down to the question of the kind of art that she wants to see as she is on this vacation. She's on a cruise down the Seine, and we haven't even mentioned the murder mystery part of it. But there is this little minor thing there where, you know, she goes to visit, I think it's Manet's place, but she's actually interested in somebody, an other artist, a woman artist's house that is near there. Tell us about that.
So Mrs. Blossom and I, you ask about overlaps. We both discovered Joan Mitchell the same way through a show at the Baltimore Museum of Art during the pandemic, or as the pandemic was kind of easing up and people were going out again. I consider myself pretty knowledgeable about art, especially female abstract expressionist. And yet, I mean, much to my chagrin, I knew nothing about Joan Mitchell. And I went to see her work at this show at the Baltimore Museum of Art. And I was at that point, not quite 2 years out of my marriage, which had coincided very helpfully with the pandemic. You know, I was in a much more tender place. And I went to the show with my daughter and I think my ex-husband, I think we were all there together. And something in my soul just opened up and I felt healed and transformed and also just more hopeful, because that's what art and beauty can do for us. And I never lost that feeling. And one of the other funny things too about where Mrs. Blossom and I kind of overlap when I talk about she's getting to decide what she wants to hang on her walls. As part of my divorce, you know, this is super privileged too. I was married to a very wealthy man who worked in television. And among our marital assets, there was a very small one-bedroom apartment in New York that we had used as an office space. We had a home there. He received that apartment and the divvying up of our things. But this little apartment, this like kind of bare bones, really ordinary one bedroom apartment, was part of what I was awarded in the divorce. And I was so sure I was going to sell it with my accountant's approval. And I walked into it one day in the summer of 2023, right as things were getting finalized. And I looked at it, I was like, no, this is where I'm going to retire. And I had the opportunity that I gave Mrs. Blossom of creating a new space for myself, a space that's super feminine. And also the walls are filled with lithographs and etchings by a lot of female abstract expressionists, Joan Mitchell among them. You know, just a small thing that I found that was from this gorgeous book that was done in conjunction with Frank O'Hara. Frank O'Hara, the poet, worked at the Museum of Modern Art, and he was friends with so many artists. And there's this amazing book in which different artists of the mid 20th century created illustrations for Frank O'Hara's work. And the one that Joan Mitchell illustrated begins, "Shall I be profligate as a blonde?" Which I just love. You know, so that's another thing we share, is this really amazing opportunity to create a space that's just for you. I mean, think about what a luxury that is. I mean, that is like privilege beyond privilege in our world, to be a woman and be able to say, this is a space that's just for me. This is where I'm going to retire, and where I spend a lot of time there because New York's only a 2.5 hour train ride away. My daughter adores it. And my daughter loves coming to me with New York, but I'm always like, this is my apartment. She's like, no, mom, if I came to school in New York, I'm like, no, this is mine. So again, another overlap with Mrs. Blossom. And I mean, Joan Mitchell is just so amazing. And I'm so embarrassed that I got to such a ripe old age without knowing her work. But, you know, now that I've found it, it really showed me, and I think it shows Mrs. Blossom, the possibility of expanding one's horizons at a time in our life when so many people think it's narrowing. I mean, I understand the fact of life, not to quote the senator from Iowa, that we're all going to die someday. But I understand that, yeah, I'm in the third act of my life by any mathematical measure. But, you know, the third act is usually pretty exciting. It's so interesting that we look at our life and think that the third act is going to be just, you know, down, 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 possibilities being erased. And it's true. There's some things that if you haven't done them by the time you're 60, you're probably not going to do them. But there's still some things you're going to do that are new. And, you know, I realize this is a murder mystery, and it's very much a proper murder mystery, but it's so much about the possibilities of a woman's life as she enters that third act.
And I think that's so much of what made it so delightful. I mean, aside from the writing and the incredibly twisty plot, but let's take a little bit closer look, without giving anything away, of course, to some of the other themes of this novel, Murder Takes a Vacation, Laura Lippman. It has to do with art theft, the art world, not just the art world in the way that we've just been talking about it, and personal reinvention, of course, but the world of art theft. What did you do some research about this? Is this something that you're particularly interested in? You know, how did that come into this book?
You know, so it happens that during the time I was beginning to sort of imagine this book and begin writing this book, the tricky issue of provenance was really in the news a lot. You were finding there are more and more problematic collections, like who really owns what? And, you know, we have the forever example of the British Museum. And there's so many great museums whose collections kind of rely on what can only be described as looted art. And there's a lot of pretzeling of ethics in order to defend not repatriating art. And a lot of art has been repatriated. And there are people who have given up their collections. And there are people who have been found guilty of knowingly accepting art that didn't have a pure and clear provenance. So I found all of that interesting and just of the moment. And it just that was just an idea that kind of snagged me. So I wanted to look at that. I wanted to play with, I really love in my writing, playing with super familiar text or stories and changing them up, especially in terms of gender. So I was rewatching Charade and I looked at it and I was like, how does this change if the older character is the woman and the younger character is the male? Like, what would change then? What would be different? I mean, I love the movie Charade. I think it's pretty perfect. And one of the things I love about it is a woman telling people, I can't possibly have what you're looking for. You know, in the film, everyone thinks there's this huge amount of money that's been hidden. And she's like, the apartment is empty. My husband was murdered. There is nothing. And in this case, they're talking about something very literal, which is a statue, a bird statue, total nod to the Maltese Falcon. And, you know, she's a pretty down-to-earth woman who says over and over again, I think I'd know if someone had sneaked a statue into my luggage. I'm paying close attention. So all of those things just kind of coalesced for me. I happened to become a docent at the American Visionary Art Museum right before I started writing this book. I entered the program in I entered the program in the fall of 2022. And so by 2023, I had started leading tours on my own.
You know, it's interesting what you say, because I was just reading how Harvard has now returned, these are photographs, not art, but photographs of a father and a daughter who were slaves, has returned it, not exactly to the family that was suing for it, but to a museum. I guess they came to an agreement it would be returned to a museum. And I really wonder if Harvard just finally broke its intransigence because of how it is now engaged in a struggle with President Trump, you know, who's basically trying to take over the university and control it, you know, as if in their struggle and their positioning as being in a place where they're really being victimized, they understood that maybe this would be a good thing to do to somebody else that they had victimized.
I'd like that if that were the connection. I mean, I think one thing that really interests me is, you know, my own thoughts about so many things have evolved over time. One of the really tiny sub-themes running through this is that Mrs. Blossom is a person who's aware that language is changing, and she doesn't always know the right thing to say, but she is always keen to say it. And I feel like I've been so baffled by people who feel, you know, feel that it's an enormous burden on them to have to think a little bit about the words we use and how we use them, to think about whether a word has undesirable origins or can words be painful? They absolutely can. I'm a huge fan of the spelling bee in the New York Times. It's like, you know, part of my daily life, and it's really important to me. And one of the things I've noticed about it, which I quite approve of, is it does not recognize the word mammy as a word. If you try to enter that, it'll be like, that's not in our word list. And I think that's a good thing. I think being considerate about language, being thoughtful about context, you know, it's not that long ago that this big plantation in Louisiana burned down. And it was a place that was used for weddings. And I remember, and we're going back about 35 years now, I remember being a youngish reporter in Baltimore, and I was meeting a photographer for an assignment. And the photographer, who was a Black woman, said to me, "I'm just so creeped out because I had to go do an assignment at a former plantation." And at the time, I didn't get it. You know, it's like, well, but that's the past. And yet, as Faulkner famously said, the past is never past. You know, the past isn't dead, the past is never past. So, you know, when that plantation burned down, look, I'm not for destruction. I'm not for, you know, but people shouldn't be having weddings at plantations. People should be conscious of the history of things. And it's complicated and knotty. And naughty, K-N-O-T-T-Y, not N-A-U-G-H-T-Y, because I know I have a funny accent. So yeah, I hope Harvard is beginning to get it as an older institution that has probably considered itself pretty unassailable. But I also think that part of living in this world today is to have an open mind about things that might have seemed benign, or, well, that's just how they did it back then. Like, yeah, but that doesn't mean that we have to honor it today.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, Muriel is a very open-minded person and quite an admirable one. You mentioned before the connection between the two of you. Did writing her character actually teach you something about yourself? When we talked about the connection, I mean, was it that you discovered that you enjoyed your single state and having the right and the ability to do whatever you want, to decorate your home any way you wanted already? Or was this something that in writing the character, you actually developed your own ideas about yourself?
I think definitely in part, some of these ideas developed, you know, in concert with writing the book. I mean, the one thing that is funny about an author and her subject, I just feel like Muriel Blossom has a level of sexual charisma that I lack. And I'm very happy for her. And it's not like I gave it to her as some sort of projection or fantasy. It's just like, no, she's got something. And I think what she has is an almost painful sincerity. She's so incapable of being anyone but herself. And I think that's, we talk so much about authenticity in our current world, but I think that's what real authenticity is when you couldn't be someone else if you tried, you wouldn't even try. She's never wanted to be anyone but herself. I mean, if you, you know, think about the backstory of growing up in a household with a mother who kind of tried to literally starve her, who rejected the idea that her daughter's body was essentially an assertion of genetics, which is what our bodies are pretty much 80% an assertion of genetics. And it's amazing how much, not just our culture, but that science has fought that idea. It's shocking. It's shocking at how many scientists were sort of still clinging to the idea of, you know, calories in, calories out. If you do that, you will not be above a certain weight. And there's a lot of really good research that has established that that's just bunk. And I know people who still fight it. So Mrs. Blossom taught me a lot. I had a lot to learn from Mrs. Blossom. You know, you begin a book as an author thinking you are the author and that you have a authorial authority, but your characters in the best situation will teach you a lot about yourself.
And has that happened with some of your other characters? I mean, I think, of course, of Tess Monahan, but others as well.
So there's a character, I don't think I'm going to identify the book or the name of the character because it's a big spoiler. But I wrote a character in one book who was superficially so admirable. Her politics, her habits, the way she spoke, her intellect, everything about her was so admirable, but she was horrible. She was a terrible, terrible person. And that was something I was working out about. One of my decades-long obsessions has been with the fact that I think it's dangerous to think of yourself as living an enviable life, and it's even more dangerous to try to live an enviable life. There's something really twisted about inviting envy, which is a terrible thing. So that's certainly something I learned from one of my characters. Yeah, most of my characters have something to teach me. I would say that I'm not sure what it is yet, but I think the character of Danny in Murder Takes a Vacation has something to teach me.
And I said, by the way, because when you said enviable life, I thought you meant that she tried to be a good person, but you were really saying she tried to be somebody that other people were envious of.
Right, right. No, trying to live a good life. I mean, I think that's the most important thing we can do. I mean, I think that the task of being human is to decide on our own values and then to live according to our own values. And that's an intensely private thing that other people might not approve of or might not even find admirable, but we're not doing it for other people. We're doing it because if I've decided that this is what a good person does, then I must do it, even if other people don't necessarily agree, because I'm not doing it for them. I'm not doing it for approval. I'm not doing it for, you know, admiration. Deciding what you think is right is pretty tricky. And then doing it is even trickier, and it's very private.
And let's go back to Danny, because I interrupted you on that, and I want to get back to that. He's a very interesting character, Laura Lippman, in this novel, Murder Takes a Vacation. Tell us about him.
So Danny is a man that Mrs. Blossom meets early in her travels, and he's 40-something, so younger than she is, extremely handsome, very well-dressed, and his story about who he is and what he does is forever changing. And he's also extremely discreet about his sexuality. And Mrs. Blossom is forever guessing in her head, you know, like, and part of the journey for Mrs. Blossom is accepting the fact that no one owes you a description of their sexuality. It's not in the public domain. If people choose to share that, that's great. But if they don't, that's also should be something that you should accept, that that's a boundary that they have established. So in Danny, I wanted to write about a man who is a little bit mysterious, very handsome. He and Mrs. Blossom both have personal secrets that are kind of weighing them down. things that they haven't talked about to anyone, stories that bring them either shame or guilt or maybe both. You know, I don't think this is a spoiler, but in the end, while there is romance for Mrs. Blossom within these pages, I felt that, unlike Charade, which is my inspiration, I was much more interested in the power of friendship and how important friends are. I have come to value my friends so much over the past few years. I think that's not uncommon. I think for a lot of us going through the pandemic, friendship, however we practiced it during a time when we couldn't be face-to-face with our friends, is really important. When I found myself out of my marriage, I looked around and I realized I had so many good friends. I hadn't even thought about it. It was like I was embarrassed at the richness of my friendship, how many there were, how varied they were. My oldest friend is, we've been friends for over 50 years. I have a friend who lives a block away who, you know, I walk with regularly and talk about with everything. But then there's just all these like neighborhood moms, and they're such good people and they're so much fun. And then I have my writer friends, and I have friends in New Orleans where I used to live part of the time. It's a pretty big circle. And I don't think I've always been a conscientious friend. I wrote an entire essay about the fact that I think I'm a really bad friend. And since writing that essay, it was like, yeah, there were some real truths in that. And I have had trouble maintaining some friendships over distance and decades. That can be challenging. But friendship is something else that it's never too late to start doing it better. And so I've really welcomed that challenge into my life. And I think that was something I really wanted Mrs. Blossom to think a lot about, friendship and what kind of friendships you need and how one friend can't be everything to you. You know, that's not going to work out either. You need, you know, she realizes as this book goes on, she needs different friends. She needs the friend who will go on a trip, but she also needs the friend who wants to go to a matinee with her, or go to an art museum, which her oldest friend isn't keen for.
Yeah. And what struck me too is that, I mean, of course, there's some villains in this novel, but both Danny and Mrs. Blossom, Muriel, are such really likable characters. And I think that's really important to a reader's enjoyment. At least, let's say, I find it important to my enjoyment of a book is that the characters, or at least some of them, be people that I would like to know. And I think so often it seems like a, you know, an expectation of fiction that you have to kind of delve into the uglier parts of the human psyche. And, you know, that has its point too, because after all, fiction wants to explore all different things. But when it comes to really enjoying a book, I need characters I'd like to know.
I mean, as a reader, I go both ways. I can spend time with really unlikable characters. I mean, I think right now my biography on Blue Sky says likable character who writes about unlikable characters, because again, the book I came off of, Problem, I was just not a likable person in the book, I don't think. I can't think of a single person that I really like in that book. And, you know, the funny thing is, though, that the cozy mystery is harder to write than the noir mystery, and a likable, a decent person, let's just put it that way, it's hard to write about a really decent person and yet make sure that they're still fun and funny and, you know, not completely ingenuous and, you know, not too good to live and just too dumb to be believed. And I think that's an interesting challenge. I'm a big fan of a book. I might get the title wrong. I don't think I'm getting it exactly right. But Nicholson Baker wrote a book, The Everlasting Story of Nori, which is just about a little girl who's having a heck of a time. Like she has all the awe and wonder of being a little kid. And to me, that's a much bigger writing challenge than, as much as I love it, and because I love this book too, that's a lot harder to write than writing Alexander Portnoy.
And why is that? And you mentioned the word cozy. Is this what differentiates a cozy mystery from others? You know, what makes it different and what makes it harder?
So a cozy mystery, by strict definition, is set in a closed community. Like the things that are happening because of personal relationships, histories. There's no serial killer from the outside who's just there to kill until he gets stopped. They also tend to be light on violence and sex and profanity. They're hard to write because I think the thing as a writing teacher I go back to again and again is the one of the most important concept, and I think this is true of all fiction, just not crime fiction. What are the stakes? What are the stakes for the characters? Because that's what will bring readers in. They have to care about what happens to these people for some reason. And within a cozy mystery, the stakes can be seemingly small. I mean, a man has been murdered in this book. It turns out that more than one man has been murdered in this book or been murdered because of this object. You know, it's just a statue of a bird that probably belongs to Pakistan, but no one else really seems to care about it. And yet, that's the job, is to make people care about it. And you do that through a character that people can root for. And it just is a really tough balancing act. It would be so much easier to write a detective novel, the serial killer is on the loose, and he's going to kill a woman every day until February is over. Yeah, that's really straightforward. It's like, oh, the hunt is on. You're not going to care about anything that happens in a book like Murder Takes a Vacation unless you care about the person at the center of it.
And so what are you balancing, though?
Well, there has to be suspense. Things have to happen. I mean, Mrs. Blossom is delightful, but if I try to write a novel, and some people have done it, I think it's Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris, and what's the name of the character who lives for a day? I'm totally blanking on it. Mrs. Someone Lives for a Day. There are definitely novels in which there are no dead bodies and women still have interesting times. But if this had just been a novel about a shy widow who found a lottery ticket and took her friend on a cruise up the set, you know, something has to happen. I mean, there are people who could probably write that as a love story and they both found love, and probably, I guess some people could write it as a science fiction story or speculative fiction. Maybe it could even be romantic-y. I mean, crime is what I do. I have never struggled with my choice to write within the crime genre. Crime is interesting. It cracks the world open and then things change.
It cracks the world open and then things change. Say more about that.
So maybe not so much in recent days, but it used to be that most of us led kind of placid lives and we're not forced to think too hard about our lives or to think about certain things. And murder in particular changes everything. And secrets are bound to be revealed. People have to face ugly truths. The tradition within a cozy mystery is that, and this is an interesting tradition now, because I don't think it's quite true anymore. The crime novel used to sort of imagine that the world was good. Murder happened. You found out about all the things that were kind of hidden beneath the surface of the good world. And in order to return to the good world, you had to solve the murder. You had to figure out what happened because that was the only way to return to order. We don't tend to live in an orderly universe right now. So I think now, bizarrely, the crime novel is holding out the fantasy of the orderly world that is disrupted and then restored. And the idea right now of an orderly world does seem to be pretty much of a fantasy, because we live in just an unruly world right now. And perhaps that's the lure right now of crime fiction, is that it's still stuck in the old world where we believed in order and that there would be a reason to try to restore that order.
And yet, well, you know, I think congratulations are in order here. You've been named a Grandmaster by the Mystery Writers of America, and you've been doing this a very long time. So looking back, have there been things that have changed, shifts in crime fiction since you started?
Oh, crime fiction will always be changing. That's the one thing you can count on. I've heard more pronouncements over it's not a 30-year career, but it's close. When I started, it was, you must write a series. Series are what people want, and you're going to have to write one a year. And then around the year 2000, when Harlan Coben and Dennis Lehane had huge successes with standalones, it was like, write standalones, standalones are what everyone wants. And it just, you know, Gillian Flynn comes along and shakes everything up with Gone Girl, a book I love extravagantly. And then it's like, this is what we're going to do. We're going to do what we call domestic suspense. And it just, the conventional wisdom of what should be done and how we're going to do it is forever changing within the crime world even. And I'm not as expert on other forms of fiction, but I do think crime fiction is very connected to what's happening in the world. A couple years ago, so in 2023, my friend Megan Abbott and I published books within weeks of each other, both of which were definitely sort of about the rights of pregnant women or the things that can happen to pregnant women. And we had started those books before Roe v. Wade had been overturned. And yet on some level, without even thinking about it explicitly, we were drawn to that. And now here we are 2 years later, books out a week apart, and mine is a cozy that is very concerned with the topic of money. Like, what does money buy you, literally and figuratively? What's enough money, and how is that affected by your expectations? You know, Mrs. Blossom has more money than she can imagine ever having, and yet she meets people who think that she's, you know, relatively not that wealthy. And my friend Megan in the said she's now publishing a book called El Dorado Road, which is about Grosse Pointe in the days when the auto industry is just no longer king and fortunes are softening and people are looking for ways to make money. And all these women get swept up in a multi-level marketing scheme and there's a murder. So crime fiction is just kind of always in dialogue with the culture one way or another. And one of the things I love about it is one genre of fiction that's very, very interested in money, which I think is one of our greatest topics.
The root of all evil, as we can say.
That's said for sure. And yet there was a period of time when money was kind of like missing in mainstream literary fiction. Like no one talked, like no one was worried about it. And I just love things like, I love James N. Cain's Mildred Pierce, where there's like a passage where she has like maybe exactly $6 to get through the week. And she has to figure out what she can buy and in terms of groceries. And I'll read something like that all day. I adore a book called Capital by John Lancaster, which looks at the 2008 economy through the prism of one block in South London, where all the houses are suddenly becoming very, very valuable. But this means very different things for each household.
Wow, that's fascinating. I'm going to post your reading list on the show notes because now I want to go out and read those books as well as more of yours. I so love this. I have to confess, this is the first book of yours that I've read. And my appetite is whetted for more.
Well, it's so different. Now you're gonna meet all these unlikable people. Although the Tess Monahan series, Tess is a very relatable, and I would like to think likable person because she's, you know, like my little sister.
I'll start there. It's just been great to talk with you.
Thank you. It was a very enjoyable conversation.
It's such an enjoyable book, Murder Takes a Vacation. I just loved it, and I would love to talk with you again for your next one.
Thank you. It was a sheer delight. Have a great day.
Grandmaster of Crime Fiction, Laura Lippman. Next up, One reporter's deep dive into Andrew Cuomo's governing style and record during the COVID-19 pandemic. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to listen again, like, and subscribe to the podcast. New York City has already begun early voting in the Democratic primary for mayor. Andrew Cuomo is still leading in the polls, although second-placer Zohran Mamdani is narrowing the former governor's lead, and Brad Lander, in third place, may get a boost after he was detained by ICE while trying to escort an immigrant out of the federal building after the man was stripped of his status by a judge who dismissed his case. Back in 2021, during the last election for New York governor, I interviewed journalist Ross Barkin about his book, The Prince, Andrew Cuomo, The Coronavirus, and the Fall of New York. It's a deep dive into Cuomo's record during the coronavirus epidemic and his governing style. Cuomo was widely criticized for causing thousands of nursing home deaths after he ordered COVID patients to be released to them from hospitals. Here's an excerpt from my conversation with Ross Barkin. Talk about Cuomo's management style, not just during COVID, but in general, and why that, in fact, turned out to be so dangerous during the pandemic.
Andrew Cuomo is someone who micromanages and politicizes facets of government that should not be politicized. He relies on a very close coterie of aides who remain in his orbit, not because they're extremely competent. They remain in his orbit because they're extremely loyal. That does not mean everyone in his orbit is incompetent. It just means that, like, a lot of, you know, leaders with authoritarian tendencies, and I'm not calling him an authoritarian, loyalty comes first. And I didn't even really get into this in the book because this would come out later on when the book was finished. The man overseeing vaccine distribution in New York State was a longtime political aide named Larry Schwartz, who had no background in science or in medicine. He was a career political operative who had been close to Cuomo for years and was given this task of overseeing how vaccines should be handed out to the various counties. And this was in, you know, the early months of this year and late last year. You have people like Melissa DeRosa, who at one time appeared on the covers of Harper's Bazaar and became a mini celebrity in her own right, you know, who is the second most powerful bureaucrat in the state. And she was given vast powers and ability to decide how COVID should be managed in New York. And she also is a, you know, career Democrat operative, you know, daughter of a lobbyist, and she's a smart person, and not denigrating her, but she is someone who is there, who exists in power because she is fiercely loyal to Andrew Cuomo. And when you have a government like that, you can have real problems. You get situations where New York doesn't shut down quickly enough because the governor and his people don't like the mayor of New York City, who says we should shut down now. And they don't want to defer to him because they don't like Bill de Blasio. You get these, like, very kind of personalized, petty conflicts that override the greater decisions that should be made. And I don't think Cuomo is Donald Trump by any means. I don't think anyone is Donald Trump, but I do think there's more similarities between the two than a lot of liberal left-leaning people would admit. And I think one of them is that both Trump and Cuomo prize loyalty above all else. And if you are blindly loyal, you'll remain. If you're not, you'll be cast out of the garden.
In your book, Ross Barkin, I hope readers will read it before they make up their minds on how they're going to vote if they're in New York for Andrew Cuomo. You are the author of The Prince, Andrew Cuomo, The Coronavirus, and the Fall of New York. So one part of this is his megalomania, his demand for loyalty. Another part of this is, which you talk about, is his ineptness. And talk about the link between these two. I mean, I remember at one point, I think Andrew Cuomo finally really lost me when he said something like, "Don't trust the experts, trust me." And I heard, I learned that something like the vast majority of his public health people resigned. To me, that was very disturbing. So what are some examples of how this management style led to really inept decision-making?
There are a few different ways it really cost the city and the state. And, you know, when you think about who remains in his government, as you said, he's had many resignations on the public health side. His public health commissioner has not resigned, Dr. Howard Zucker, and he's remained in part because he's been very loyal to Cuomo. And he's been, you know, in essence, another arm of kind of this political machine and not really an independent public health official. You know, I always start at the beginning with the fact that the state of New York, like Mayor Bill de Blasio in New York City, was really downplaying the threat of COVID. Cuomo repeatedly compared it to the flu, compared it to Ebola, compared it to SARS, said the fear is worse than the virus itself. And he himself was at these press conferences at the center of the dais, making these proclamations. Cuomo was not letting independent public health experts speak at length about the threat of COVID. You contrast that with, for example, Washington State, where very early on, Jay Inslee, the governor, deputized public health officials to lead the response and to be the public face of the response, to communicate to people, this is serious, this is going to get worse. Now, you saw this in the end of February of 2020 in Washington State. And then you had days later, you know, even weeks later, Andrew Cuomo is still on stage as late as mid-March saying, this is like the flu, don't worry. And it was so divorced from reality at that point. You know, we're talking about anyone with a brain could see this was going to be very bad, and this was spreading uncontrolled. This had happened in Europe, but it happened in China, and it was going to happen here. You can just read a newspaper and see that. So you start there at the beginning, and you look at New York's slowness to implement a shutdown order, doing it after California did, even though there are many more cases. And that also speaks to Cuomo's style, that he was only going to do it on his terms. He wanted to call it New York pause. He didn't like that Bill de Blasio got out in front of him and said, it's going to be time for New York to go into a lockdown. He said, no, it's not. I make that decision, not you. And, you know, Cuomo had these remarkable emergency powers in place, which didn't really get a lot of attention. I write about in my book a bit where he could really decide unilaterally whatever it is he wanted to do in New York State. You know, there was really no place of input for the mayor, for any county executive. And so the buck stopped with him in every way. Then, of course, there's the nursing home debacle, which I haven't even gotten into yet, where New York had a very odd policy of readmitting COVID positive patients into nursing homes, and they were discharged from hospitals. And Cuomo blamed this on the federal government, but this was not a hard federal policy. This was the policy of his government. And he argued with some plausibility that you need to free up hospital beds by sending these people back to nursing homes. But he did not really seek any alternatives, like maybe moving some of these patients into the large temporary hospital facilities that had been set up and were largely unused, whether it was at the Jacob Javits Center in New York City in Manhattan or the Tennis Center in Queens. I mean, these largely sat empty. And then the real sin of undercounting nursing home deaths, which didn't lead to more carnage, but led to an inability to understand the extent of the death toll in New York, in these nursing homes, where people who died, who got sick in a nursing home and got transported to a hospital, were not counted as nursing home deaths. And there was no logic to this. This is not how other states counted nursing home deaths. And this was kind of the beginning of Cuomo's unraveling, where, like Richard Nixon, he needed to cover up this reality to make himself look better, you know, certainly for his book and for the public in general. And that was not a public health decision to undercount nursing home death. This was not something any independent public health expert would have done. This was something that Andrew Cuomo and Melissa DeRosa wanted to do. So it was done, and someone like Howard Zucker merely had to play ball and follow along. And then that's the type of government he's run. You know, it's this mixture of top-down authoritarian-like governance and also a degree of incompetence as well, and a lot of failure. There's a lot of failure around COVID in New York, and that can't be avoided.
Ross Barkin talking with me in 2021 about his book, The Prince. Go to writersvoice.net for the full interview. And I have exciting news. I've started hosting a new podcast for Change Hampton, an organization dedicated to promoting a new land ethic that creates habitat for wildlife, birds, and beneficial bugs. The podcast name is Change Hampton Presents, Changing the World One Yard at a Time. Look for it wherever you get your podcasts. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, check out our archives, and find out more about this week's guests. You can find our social media links there, too. And don't forget to subscribe, like, and link to our podcast. It really helps to spread the word about the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.